Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you can check out the events page where you can come and hang out with Chad and I and Loso and Scott Keith and Gretchen Ronovic and Jared C. Wilson and come listen to Andy Gullihorn play a bunch of music. That's all going to be taking place in Northwest Arkansas, Bentonville to be exact, April 16th and 17th, 2021. I know you haven't been doing a lot of stuff this year. I know you've been locked up. I know you haven't been able to go hang out with people. Now's your chance. You can come hang out with us in the spring, in the Ozarks. Go get all the information. Just go to the events page, or you can go to herewestillstand.org. Click on that Northwest Arkansas event. It's a two-day event. We'd love to have you come hang out with us. Chad, your book is officially out.
Officially out.
No more of this pre-order, guys. Maybe you're one of those people that is like, oh, I don't pre-order. I order when I know it's going to get stuck in the mail the day I click buy. Well, this is your time now, guys. This is your time.
This is it.
You can get it. You hit buy. It's going to go in the mail to you right then and there. So Unveiling Mercy, if you didn't pre-order and you're waiting for it to be released, it is released. Get that thing now. Get your Christmas gifts going. You know, you can hang out with me as I go through it next year. This is my plan, Chad. I mean, I've read a lot of it already, but my plan is to actually read it every day next year. That's my plan.
All right, cool. Yeah. I guess I should probably reread it for like the fifth time.
I just can't wait for how holy I'm going to come out on the other side of this.
Oh man, you're going to be so sanctified. You're going to be like high priest sanctification by the end of the year.
I assume.
Hebrew.
Yeah, the magic language. It's going to be awesome.
Right. Everything went well. Super exciting day. So glad to see it's finally there. Always, when you do like this pre-order phase, it always feels like it goes for like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then all of a sudden the day arrives and it's like, yeah, finally get that in people's hands.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, man, check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. All right. Well, we left off with Samuel anointing David as king while another king still remains.
Yeah, it's not like a dangerous situation.
Yeah, this is not yeah. The way that you don't usually want to do it this way.
No, it's gonna well, and we'll see, of course, in the next few chapters just how badly this goes. You know, I don't know that Saul ever actually finds out what Samuel did. I mean, as far as like what happens in Bethlehem. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But he certainly realizes pretty quickly that his kingship is over and a new man is on the horizon. And he figures out, of course, he's already been told that God is going to raise up someone else. He just doesn't know who this is. But he's going to figure. He's going to put two and two together pretty quick.
Yeah, it's almost as if David is king-elect here and and current king is not a fan of this arrangement.
yeah that would be the appropriate way to put it. So we have a juxtaposition between the two halves of this chapter with talk of the Spirit. So the way this anointing scene ends in Bethlehem is that Samuel takes this horn of oil that he's brought with him, and he anoints David in the middle of his brothers. Of course, you probably all know that word for anoint, the verb for anoint is where we get our word Messiah. So he messiahed him. So an anointed one is a Mashiach. So he was Mashiached here, anointed in the midst of his brothers. And interesting, when this anointing happened, something else happened. It says the Spirit of Yahweh came mightily upon David from that day forward. So this connection between anointing and Spirit is pretty obvious here. And you might think of Jesus' baptism like this too. Even though his baptism was not his anointing, that wasn't when Christ was Messiah'd. Still, you have him baptized, and what happens? Well, immediately the Spirit of God descends in the form of a dove and lights upon him. So David here is little M Messiah'd. He becomes the anointed one. And the Spirit rushes upon him. And then after that, Samuel basically just goes home. It's like his job is done. He's anointed the next king.
That's kind of a weird thing, right? Like, all right, man, get that shepherd out here, roll him up, anoint him, and then you're just like, and I'm out.
Yeah,
that's kind of weird.
Conversations going on afterward.
If you're David, are you like, So what am I doing right now?
Yeah, I know. Like, do you leave him some instructions? Like, yeah, just wait around, you know, or start doing this, or like, how do you get ready to be a king?
Yeah, I mean, especially when there's one already, there is a king. It's like, hey, you're the new king. Like, are you like, am I the new king? Am I the next king? I got to wait for the, like, what's going on here? Like
this, yeah, there's a big difference between new and next,
yeah,
right?
And this is not real explicit. What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of unanswered questions. I wish we do.
In fact, a lesser man than David, you know, and we'll see this play out this way, might be like, well, I'm the king now. So that means I'm taking over.
I'm the man.
Yeah. Your time has come to an end. It was short-lived, and now it's me. David doesn't do that because he's not interested in going to war with Saul or anything like that. But it's not because he was given some special instructions here not to do that.
Yeah, yeah. It is fascinating. Now, when you said that, I was thinking ahead. Yeah, how many times David will say something like, you shall not touch the Lord's anointed. So he continues, even though Saul is just horrible to him, you know, tries to kill him, hunts him down, gives him no peace. Despite all that, even though David has multiple chances actually to kill Saul, he says, nope, I won't touch the Lord's anointed. So even though he himself is anointed, even though that God has designated him to be the next king and even anointed him, he won't do anything to expedite his reign. Yeah. He's going to wait and let the Lord do what the Lord's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think David thinks like, well, God plucked me out of obscurity and said that I was going to be king, but I am not going to put myself in that position by removing the one that he had put in there in front of me. He might have chosen me to be king, but he's also going to have to remove him as king. I'm not going to be the one to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So David's restraint is exemplary. You know, we've not seen that same restraint in other people in the narrative so far. People are always kind of rushing to make sure that, you know, God might promise something. I'm thinking of Abraham and Sarah. God might promise something, but you know, if he drags his feet too long, yeah, well, we'll just take measures into our own hands.
Yeah. Help him out a little bit. David could help God out. Let me go ahead and get rid of this other king so I can go ahead and have your will come to pass where I'm king.
I think there's some practical wisdom there.
Yes.
So I mentioned earlier the juxtaposition with the Spirit. So here's what happens between verses 13 and 14. So the Spirit of the Lord comes on David. And then verse 14, which begins the next section, says, now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. And not just that, but it says an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. So a lot of spirit talk here, and we're going to see more of this spirit talk through the next few verses. I don't really know. I'm not sure exactly what to make of all this. It's really it's quite a fascinating description of how the Lord is at work here. I mean, as we all know, we tend to talk about secondary causes. So rather than saying God directly caused A, B, C, we'll say, well, this caused A, this caused B, this caused C. And yeah, we might trace all the causes back to God. But a typical Old Testament way of approaching things is to say, God did it. Yeah, God closed her womb. God sent an evil spirit. God killed him, whatever it might be. That is the typical way that the Old Testament speaks. They don't talk of secondary or tertiary causes. And that's kind of what's happening here. So God takes a spirit away from Saul, and he sends an evil spirit to terrorize him or to assault him. That verb can be translated several different ways. Whatever is actually happening here, it becomes pretty obvious that this signals a radical transition. So even though Saul's still king, he's still the Lord's anointed, the spirit that he once had has now been replaced by a spirit that is going to continue to kind of wreak probably physical and certainly psychological havoc with him. I wish we knew more about exactly what was happening with Saul when this went down, but it's obviously bad, whatever's going on with him, you know, whether it's some sort of mental issues or just kind of the sheer psychological terror that's happening to him, whatever he needs some assistance, which of course is what we're about to have explained to us.
Yeah, this is a tough thing, I think, for people. You know, when you read something like, "Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him." Now, there's a difference between the Spirit of the Lord and a spirit from the Lord. Now, these are not the same things. Yeah. And you might be like, well, really, like a harmful spirit from the Lord? Is that a thing? And I think, as these, you know, at least the way that I read this is, I think it's Luther that says, like, the devil is God's devil.
Yeah, right.
It seems to me that, like, when the Spirit of the Lord departs, it creates space for something to take its place. Yet, even for something to take that space that is created, God has to allow it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, I mean, we see the examples of this, you know, like when, you know, the devil approaches God about Job and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems that this is not like the Spirit of the Lord, obviously, but that because God is sovereign and because God has removed his Spirit and created the space for something else to occupy, the author here is willing to say that it is from the Lord since he himself is in control.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the best way to explain it. It's kind of like, I can't remember the exact language that Jesus uses, but about the analogy uses about the house that's vacated and then all these other unclean spirits come and occupy that. So this is an interesting place in the Old Testament, by the way, that where we do have this kind of language. You know, we have exorcisms and demon possession, evil spirits all over the Gospels, but it's not very common in the Old Testament. But here we do have a case like this. I mean, when you look at what's about to happen, it's almost like David is functioning as a sort of a musical exorcist, I suppose, would be one way to put it. He's there to, maybe not to completely exorcise Saul, but he is there to at least provide some relief through his, I guess you'd say, inspired playing of the harp. So this is one of these Old Testament parallels to what's happening in the Gospels, which I think is interesting because, of course, we have all these analogies between David and the son of David. So David is here having power over the evil spirits, just like the son of David will during his own ministry. Okay, so what's going to happen? Well, Saul's servants say to him, "Behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. So let our Lord command us who are before you, and let's seek a man who's a skillful player in the harp, and it will come to pass that when the evil spirit from God is on you, that he'll play the harp, and you will be well." So somehow these guys just know exactly what's needed. So they come up with this proposal. And Saul's like, "Hey, sounds good to me. Provide for me a man who can play well and bring him to me." Then we have this next verse just is a little over the top. It's almost like this has all been set up. Like there's a guy there in Saul's court who's just waiting for the chance, because he says, so one of the young men, he steps forward and he's like, "Hey, I know a guy. So I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is, he's everything. He's a skillful musician. He's a mighty man of valor. He's a warrior. He's one prudent in speech, and he's good looking. Now, on top of all that, the Lord is with him." You know, I crack up because it's almost like he's a little overqualified.
Yeah, most of these things don't seem like they have anything to do with the job. Like, you're like, "Hey, right. I need a bricklayer. I know just the guy. This guy's great at laying bricks. Also, he trains dogs. He's very good looking guy. He makes the best chili that you've ever had." Like, you're like, "What? You're bringing up stuff that has nothing to do."
Just need a bricklayer. Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly right. He sounds a little overqualified. I mean, I just need a guy who can play the harp.
Yeah,
that's really all I'm looking for here.
Yeah, it's almost like he's like they're saying, like, "This guy could play the harp. He could also be your bodyguard." Yeah. I don't know what him being good looking has to do with anything to do with any of this.
I don't either. But talking about multi-talented, he's got it all. So it just comes across as a as a little over the top. Like this guy, he's already like a David groupie. I mean, he knows this guy and he wants him there. So he just kind of lavishes all these compliments on David. So Saul's like, hey, I get, sounds good to me. So he sends these messengers to Jesse with a pretty short to the point message. He says, send me your son, David, who's with the flock. So he finds out his name, and not just his name, but he finds out that he's going to be out there with the sheep. So Jesse, maybe he's thinking, this is kind of this is the Lord at work after Samuel left, having anointed my son. This must be the Lord at work. Jesse's like, all right, sounds good. So he takes a donkey and takes some bread and a jug of wine and a young goat, and he sent them to Saul by David, his son. So David doesn't go empty-handed. David goes with a bunch of provisions for the king. I guess when you go see the king, you make sure you take gifts with you. And then everything, verse 21, everything looks great so far. David gets there and serves Saul and says Saul loved him. Saul loved him greatly, and he became not just all the other things, but he also became his armor bearer. And he liked him so much that Saul sent another message to Jesse saying, let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. And then we wrap up the chapter with this. So it came about whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, that David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed. Literally, in the Hebrew, it is, and a spirit would come to Saul. So a spirit coming to Saul is translated here as he would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. So through whatever means, I don't know exactly how this worked, but God was using David's playing of the harp to drive away the evil spirit and then to bring a soothing, refreshing spirit to Saul in its place.
Yep, God of means, even if it's playing the harp.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, whatever God chooses to use, whatever earthly means he uses to accomplish his will, that is in accord with the way that he always works.
Yeah,
and he's the God of means.
You do have to wonder, like, if you're David or if you're Jesse, and then Samuel comes in, anoints David king, and then Saul's like, yo, send me your son up here. This is a little sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're like, how's this going to go? Did you hear something? Because, we have to assume that Saul doesn't know anything about this.
Right. Yeah. Not at this point.
But it would seem like a little bit of a weird coincidence if the king then is like immediately like, send your son over here. I want him to, hang out with me for a little while. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd be like, I don't know if I'm sending my son up there.
I'm sure Jesse had a little talk with David. It's like, hey, when you get up there, let's just not talk about the whole Samuel thing. let's avoid that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a little nerve wracking, I would think, when you first walked into the room with him for the first time.
Yeah, because as far as we know, nothing else was communicated to David or to Jesse. It just says, send me your son.
Yeah.
Okay.
That could be good.
Sounds very threatening.
It could be good, or it could be very bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Whenever someone that powerful sends for you, it's probably gonna be one or the other. It's gonna be like a very, very good day, or it's gonna be the very worst day of your life.
Yeah.
One of those two. Well, and as it turned out, at least for David, it started out great. Saul liked him. Not just liked him as a person, but he was able to benefit, of course, from David's harp-playing ability. So right away, what do we know about David so far? Well, we know that he's a shepherd. He is the youngest. He's obviously pretty good as a musician. He's good-looking. If we can trust the guy in the court, he's got all this other stuff going for him, too. I don't know how in the world he called him a mighty man of valor and a warrior, because he was too young to be going to battle yet.
Have heard about the lion and the bear or whatever.
Yeah. Rumors spread about this shepherd boy in Bethlehem who would seize a lion by the beard and strike him down.
Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't just go on and on. You should see this dude with a slingshot. It's out of control.
Yeah. So this is all set up for what's about to come up in one of the most well-known chapters in the Bible. This is the story, the beloved story that anyone who went to school, to Sunday school, grew up learning about.
Maybe I'm hesitant to say the most, but I don't know. Like, I mean, as far as like culturally appropriated stories in the Bible, it's got to be number one, right?
Yeah, it's in the top three for sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, just think of, I mean, there's a lot of biblical names and expressions, idioms that have entered into our language, but Goliath is pretty close to the top there.
Yeah, I mean, you know? if you're into sports like I am, I mean, you hear this all the time.
Oh, the analogy, overdone, right?
Yeah, I mean, every March, I mean, my favorite sporting event of the year is the NCAA basketball tournament, March Madness. You're going to hear this term a million, like every time that little school upsets that big school, that's what it is. I mean, like it's the regular David and Goliath matchup. I mean, like it's that and Cinderella story. That's the two things, you know? And so, right. I don't know if you just walked up to a, maybe this is because I live in the South, I don't know, but I think I could walk up to 100 people and make a reference to David and Goliath and they'd all know what I was talking about.
Yeah, I think even people who have not stepped foot in church their whole life, who've never read a page out of the Bible, they might not be able to tell you anything about the details of the biblical story, but they know exactly what David and Goliath means.
They know it's little guy versus big guy.
Yep, underdog versus the powerful.
Yeah.
So in that way, the story has become thoroughly entrenched in our culture. And as a result of that, as you might expect, the flip side of that is it also has become the most abused and misunderstood and misused portion of the Old Testament as well. I mean, I mentioned earlier about Sunday school. Anyone who's gone to Sunday school, let me put it differently. Almost anyone who's gone to Sunday school has heard this story twisted into a moralizing, fairy tale-ish kind of account. I mean, we've all heard, you know, you need to slay the Goliaths in your life or whatever trite expression is used, which as will become obvious as we work our way through this pretty long chapter, is not the message that is being sent here. I mean, if anything, one of the things that comes across about Goliath, and we'll see this in the opening few verses, is he looks like just this huge, monstrous goofball out there on the battlefield who couldn't hardly defend himself to save his life because he is, he's like got 500 pounds of armor and weaponry on him. I mean, there's very little that Goliath could do against maybe anyone except his own size, because he just looks like a big fool out there with like 125 pounds worth of metal strung over his body.
Yes, a hard guy to kill, it would seem.
Yeah, hard guy to kill, but an easy guy to attack.
Yes.
If you have any kind of projectile, like a sling or a bow and arrow, or even a spear, a javelin. I mean, he's not going to be that difficult to engage in battle with. Well, anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. So let's start at the beginning. So we're back with the Philistines now, our enemies we have encountered for quite some time now, dating all the way back to the book of Judges. The Philistines gathered their armies for battle. So I'm thinking probably what happened was, you know, they heard rumors of Saul's problems. And so they thought, we're going to take advantage of this, and we are going to go on the offensive and try and get back some of the land which Saul has taken away from us. So they get their army together and they gather to fight against the people of Judah. And verse 2 says, Saul and the men of Israel were gathered, and they camp in the valley of Elah, and they drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. So you got verse 3, the Philistines on one side of the mountain, and you got the Israelites on the other side of the mountain with a valley between them. So everything is set up here, right? And you would think, if that's all you knew, those first three verses, you think, oh, we're about to have like a big battle. between the two armies. But that's not going to be the way that it works. Verse 4 introduces us to the man, to Mr. Goliath. It says, a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath. He was from Gath, and his height was, well, most translations will put in cubits, 6 cubits and a span, which is about, so a cubit is usually designated as a foot and a half, 18 inches. So, and a span is like the span of your hand. So most of your measurements will come out to something like 9 feet, 9 inches, I guess, something like that. Now, one thing I will point out, probably just this once, I might mention it once or twice after this, if it's significant. But for Old Testament scholars who like compare the Hebrew and the Greek, the Septuagint together, this is like one of the go-to places. Evidently, there's a number of discrepancies between the Greek translation's version of events and the Hebrew's version of events. The Septuagint, the Greek translation, is significantly shorter than the Hebrew version is. So, and people have various theories, you know, as well, was the Septuagint like the original story? It was shorter, then the Hebrew expanded that, or was the Hebrew the original story and the Septuagint shrunk that down? I mean, there's all kinds of theories. In the end, it really doesn't matter. Just pointing out, the reason I brought it up now is because the Septuagint also differs in some of the details. So the Septuagint only has Goliath being 6 feet, 9 inches tall, which is just, what, a couple inches taller than what you are, Dan?
I'm 6'5", almost 6'6".
So if the Septuagint were right, you're almost Goliath's height.
There you go. Yeah.
You're almost there.
Yeah, and that would be, you know, especially if you're not built like I am. So I'm like a lean 6'5".
You're a lean
five,
fighting machine.
Yeah, I'm a lean 6'5" If a regular, like a big dude, like a big 6'5" dude is a pretty big guy. I mean, I'm just a tall guy. This happens to me a lot. People ask if I shop at the Big and Tall, and I say, no, because I'm only tall. So, right, the other stuff, that big part, those clothes don't fit me. Like, I'm not big, I'm just tall. Seems that the Goliath is probably a big and tall shopper. Seems like what he is. And you have to remember that the average height of people back then was shorter than it is now. And so,
probably 5'3"-ish, I'd say 5'4", something like that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, average height in the United States is something like 5'10 or something like that for a guy now. And, you know, I get asked all the time how tall I am. Now imagine, you know, the average height is not 5'10", but it's 5'4". You know, like, well, you're talking about a guy that is probably, you know, 14 inches taller than everybody else. That's a big guy.
Yeah. I wish we knew his weight. That's one thing that we're not told.
Well, the reason I'm saying he's probably a big guy, because if you have like 100-something pounds of armor on, as you take my frame, you throw 100-something pounds of armor, I'm gonna be struggling.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's obviously not just tall, but he's big. There's no other way that he'd be able to hold up this much weight. So whether we take the extravagant number from the Hebrew, which is about 9'9", or even the number from the Septuagint, which is 6'9". I mean, either way, comparatively, this guy's big. So he's like, you know, he's like the mountain, more or less. He's like Thor.
But you can take like certain guys. I mean, I think LeBron James is 6'9", you know, 6'9", 280.
Yeah,
just a massive dude. Now, if you throw like a 5'4" guy in comparison, I mean, this guy looks like he will mess you up.
Right. Yeah. So the mere size of his body was impressive, but then we're not done yet because we have to talk about all his armor. And by the way, this is the most in the Old Testament. This is the most detailed description of armor that we have anywhere. So head to toe, he's got a bronze helmet on his head, which is probably slightly different than what a lot of the Philistines wore, at least if we could trust the Egyptian art. So the Egyptians had a lot of encounters with Philistines, and the Egyptians would depict the Philistines sometimes in their artwork. And many of them were wearing like a headdress. So that's not what Goliath has on. And maybe he wore this because he was the man of the hour and he was ready for battle. Anyway, whatever it was, he had a bronze helmet on his head. And then he was clothed with this scale-like armor, which weighed about 125 pounds, something like that. Now, many, many commentators would point this out, and rightly so, that the word for scale that is used here is the same Hebrew word that is used multiple other places to talk about, like, the scales on a fish or the scales on other reptiles. So they suggest, and I think they're onto something, that Goliath is presented here as almost a monstrous serpent kind of figure, which I like because it actually fits with that kind of sub theme of the scriptures where the serpent is waiting to have his head crushed. Well, what's going to happen to Goliath's head? That's going to get crushed by David very, very soon. So even if you don't accept that, you do, I think, have to accept the fact that Goliath is one of many representations of the evil one who is going to be overcome by God's designated champion. So this isn't just a story about, you know, a superior force and an underdog. This is a story about God working through a human being to prefigure the ultimate victory that's going to be won when his chosen one, his chosen champion, the son of David, crushes the head of another scaly one of the serpent himself. So his scale armor is 125 pounds. That's our a reference to how much it weighed. And not only does he have that on, but he has bronze greaves, which are your the armor over your legs, specifically from your feet to your knees. So he's got those on. And then we don't know for sure what he had slung between his shoulders. The New American Standard translates it as javelin. I've also read it translated as scimitar. I'm not sure what the ESV has there. Say javelin too.
Yeah, javelin.
Yeah. It only occurs this one place in the Hebrew Bible, so we're not exactly sure how to translate that. But anyways, another weapon, whether it was a scimitar type blade or a javelin. Anyway, it was slung between his shoulders. And we're not even done yet. We got to get to this spear. So his spear was like a weaver's beam. And the head of his spear weighed around anywhere from 15 to 19 pounds, 600 shekels of iron. And then his shield carrier also walked before him. Now, okay, you're a giant. I get it. You're big, you're tough, you're strong. But really throwing a spear with a 19-pound head on it, that is not going to go very far. I mean, gravity is going to take over. You're not going to be chunking that spear 50 yards.
Now, this all seems like mostly for show, right?
I think so, yeah. That's what I mentioned earlier. He's just like, he's on display out there. He just made to look big and tough and strong. And I'm not saying he wasn't. It's just that he almost looks like a buffoon out there because there's not a whole lot he can do. He's weighed down with all of this. He's not going to be able to fight very well with the weapons that he does have. He's going to throw that 19-pound spear 5 or 10 yards at the most, and that's going to be it. So he's, in other words, Goliath is, he's positioned for hand-to-hand combat, and that's about it. That's really all that he's going to be able to accomplish. Okay, so and he has this shield bearer in front of him who's an extra protection in case someone comes at him. Well, he walks out in front of Israel, and he gives his little speech. Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine? And you, servants of Saul, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, well, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. And then he said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And then we have this concluding verse to this particular section. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Well, what's going on here? Well, I wish I had it in front of me. I think the word is monomachia. anyway, there's a Greek word that's used to describe what's happening here. So often what you had in ancient warfare is you would not have two armies clash with everybody fighting. Instead, you would choose your champion and the other side would choose their champion. And these two guys would fight as representatives of their entire army. So Goliath isn't just making stuff up when he says this. He's more or less saying, okay, I'm representing the Philistines. You send a guy to represent the Israelites. The two of us will duel it out. Whoever wins, that army will be declared the winner. And whoever loses, that army will be declared the loser. And you'll have master and servant that's established when this one-on-one battle is finished.
Well, this is sort of a way to be like, a lot of guys here, a lot of people going to die, or we could do it this way.
Yeah, so it makes sense. It's a whole lot better than having two armies clash with a whole lot of people, dying. And this was not just in this particular battle. This happened a lot of times in ancient warfare. The problem was, of course, as we saw, that nobody from the Israelite army was willing to go out and fight. Now, there is an issue here, because if you think back to the days of the book of Numbers, you realize that the history is, maybe it's not repeating itself, but it is certainly rhyming here, because what happened with the Israelites when they came to the brink of the promised land is kind of what's happening now with Saul as they're facing this Philistine giant. You will remember that this is not the first time we've encountered giants. You know, there were giants in the promised land. And when the Israelites got to the border of the promised land, they were scared to death because the spies came back and they said, yeah, you know, country's great. However, there is a problem. And it's literally a big problem, because there are these big people there, these giants there. And us compared to them is like, we're grasshoppers. So what happened with the Israelites? The exact same thing that happened here with Saul and his army. They were dismayed and they were greatly afraid. And so they refused to cross over and to do battle against them. And we all know how that story ended. The Israelites ended up wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. Now, after that time, when they came to the promised land, it wasn't as if the giants had disappeared. They were still there, except this time, under the leadership of Joshua and Caleb and men such as them, they crossed over, they did battle, and they conquered the promised land, and they killed a bunch of the giants. And those who were left, were told in the book of Joshua, I think it's Joshua 11, those who were left ended up, guess where? They ended up in the Pentapolis of the Philistines. They went down there to cities like Gath and Ascalon and some of these other Philistine cities, and that's where they settled. So Goliath is a descendant of those people who were driven there by Joshua and the Israelites. So it's kind of come back again to a decisive moment in Israel's history. What's going to happen? Is Israel going to fight against these giants with the help of the Lord, or are they going to cower in fear and once more repeat the same mistakes as their forefathers?
Yeah, it also tells you that Goliath probably doesn't have a lot of real fond feelings for the children of Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a history.
Yeah.
There's a history between his people and the Israelite people.
I'm sure he's been told bedtime stories about how terrible they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that he's just itching. He's itching for a fight to kind of repay what was done to his ancestors. And keep in mind too, this isn't just, you know, trash talking from one army to another. He's not only defying the armies of Israel, he is also defying the God of the Israelites.
Yeah.
Because they did not think of this as some sort of secularized warfare. All of this was theological warfare. So whoever won, their God would also win. You know, did the Philistines win? Well, they would have thought their God gave them victory, and thus they would have thought Yahweh was defeated. And then the opposite of that would have been true as well. So what we're looking at here is a momentous occasion. It's a theological battle, much like happened in Egypt, that happened in the Promised Land, and now that is happening once more. So we will pick it up there next time and see how God is going to raise up another Joshua, whose name is David, and we'll get all the details next week.
Well, next week, yeah, we do the Sunday School corrective next week. It's going to be
that's it.
It's going to be good. Yeah, you don't want to miss it. David and Goliath. next week we're going to do the true story. Not the Sunday school felt board. It's more gruesome.
It's much more gruesome.
It's less about you than you think. It's gonna be great. All right, guys, go over to Amazon and order Chad's book. It's out. You're going to need that to do your daily devotions, for 2021. You're going to need that to get that mercy unveiled. So go check that out. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, see you here.